Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Tremaine Lee, whose new book is A Thousand Ways to Die: The True Cost of Violence on Black Life in America. Tremaine Lee is a Pulitzer Prize and Emmy Award-winning journalist and MSNBC contributor. He's the host of the Into America podcast, where he covers the intersection of blackness, power, and politics. A contributing author to the 1619 Project, he's reported for the New York Times, HuffPost, and the Times-Picayune and the New Orleans Advocate. A Thousand Ways to Die: The True Cost of Violence on Black Life in America is his first book. Tremaine Lee, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
What a lot you managed to pack into this book, from the personal to the political. And you start with a meditation on death, specifically Black death, that began when you suffered a near-fatal heart attack at a very early age.
That's right. This really began many years before the making of this book. By the time it's out, it'll be 10 years in the making. But things really shifted pretty dramatically in 2017 when I suffered a heart attack at the age of just 38 years old. Before then, I was writing a book on the true cost of gun violence, and I was using a kind of cynical device, but I was going to look into the true cost in terms of actual dollars as a way to rope in folks who might not care about the young man or woman who was shot and killed in Pickett City, USA. I said, let me just look at the actual cost as a way to bring people in. But then when I suffered my heart attack, it forced me to reckon with mortality in a very different kind of way. And my daughter then, who was 6 years old, was asking me about how I almost died and why. And to answer her honestly, I had to get really truthful and vulnerable about what it was that was bearing down on my heart. And that was a career telling stories of Black death, but also a kind of psychic trauma, inherited trauma from my own family history, going back to the Jim Crow South 100 years earlier, and me never fully understanding, unpacking, or processing what it was I was carrying in my heart until it almost broke it. And that changed everything.
We should say your daughter's name is Nola, which I love.
Yes, she's wonderful.
You have that special interest in gun violence, which you trace all the way back to slavery. And guns during slavery have a complicated history.
That's right. So I think for a lot of us, when we think about slavery and enslaved people, I think some of us tend to believe that all these enslaved people just happened to be the natural byproduct of war, right? Prisoners of war in Africa, and the Europeans seeking a need to fill labor needs, bartering with locals, right? But in reality, there's something called the guns for slaves cycle. And so while gun technology was rising in Europe, European powers were actually plying local regional African powers with the guns. Mm-hmm. So different countries were dealing with different groups of people. And so it's fomenting unrest, creating war that created more enslaved people. And so one would say, you know, to those in Angola, hey, you know, the Portuguese are dealing with those over here, right? So there's this arms race that destabilized the region and created this surplus of people, prisoners of war, because they were creating more war. And so when you think about African peoples traded for guns, and right, some European powers would only trade guns for humans. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that we were pushed out of Mother Africa with the muzzle of a gun at our back, and then we arrive at the Western world on these plantations and these prison camps, and we have these cute names for what was happening, but really transnational human trafficking rings, right, in concentration camps and labor camps. Right. And that's what they were forced into, just to be met with other white men with guns. And so the fact that from the very beginning, our lives have been bound to the gun, I think it says something, you know, beyond the physical. There's something else happening there, I believe.
Mm-hmm. And then you bring home the troubles with guns in your own family, that there are so few families whose lives are not touched by gun violence in some ways. So talk about that personal experience.
Yeah, that's right. from an early age, I'd always been told the story of my grandpa Horace, Worthington, who was shot and killed in 1976. My grandmother and grandfather had an apartment in Camden, New Jersey that they were renting out. And a man came one day and left a deposit and disappeared for many weeks. And when he finally came back, won his money back, my grandfather told him that it was non-refundable and that he'd see him in court. That man came back and shot and killed my grandfather over a $160 deposit on the apartment. And so I grew up knowing about my grandfather's murder, and it was like this gaping wound. But it wasn't until I started investigating further that I learned that my grandfather's killing wasn't the first in the family. The very first one that we can trace back to is in 1922 in rural Jim Crow, Georgia, in Ben Hill County. My great-grandparents were tenant farmers in Dodge Hill, a place called Rhine, Georgia. And one day they sent their 12-year-old son, Cornelius, who was my grandmother's brother, into the neighboring town to handle some errands. And he was shot and killed in a sundown town called Fitzgerald, where it's documented that they all came together to vote that Black folks would not be able to fully participate in life in that town. And I always thought until then that the idea of a sundown town, I thought it was colloquial somehow. I thought it was just like, you know, it's a place where it's not welcoming. But no, these men voted, and this is the late 1800s, voted to expel Black folks from most business in town. And so that killing right there sent my family into the waves of the Great Migration, with millions of other Black folks fleeing the South, looking for better opportunities, but also flee the violence. But what they found in the North, alongside some opportunity, were also pretty strict tenets of racism in the North as well. And so in the 1950s, another of my grandmother's brothers, a teenager named McClinton, was shot and killed by a state trooper. And when I started reading about this story in the newspaper, the headline just jumped out to me. It says, "Trooper's gun kills youth." And this gun just popped up and kills the young man. And it reminded me so much of my coverage of Michael Brown and Ferguson or Trayvon Martin or so many other young Black men killed for being essentially Black in the wrong place at the wrong time. And so there's this history that goes back more than 100 years in my family, almost every generation. And still 20 years after my grandfather's killing in 1976, my stepbrother was also murdered in Camden, New Jersey, by a girl. And then some years after that, in the early 2000s, another cousin was killed in Atlantic City. And so for my family, we've experienced every kind of gun violence in this country, from the white supremacist Jim Crow South kind of violence to violence of police to the violence of community time and again. And so in trying to disentangle what it means to carry that inheritance, how it shapes life, how we raise our children differently, what it says about the limitations placed on Black life in this country, I think it also speaks to how we're trying to live. And so with this book, as much as it is about shining a light in the dark places where violence has visited us time and again, it's also looking to my own daughter's eyes. And she's asking me, "Daddy, how did you almost die?" And to be honest with her, but to say there are 1,000 ways that we die, but there are also as many ways to live. And so trying to also be honest and shine a light and name a thing of what this is and hopefully grow from it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tremaine Lee, whose new book is 1,000 Ways to Die, The True Cost of Violence on Black Life in America. You write about gun manufacturing and gun trafficking in a way that is very accessible and interesting, because the iron pipeline is something that's very real.
That's right. We have, in this country, we have these, it's kind of like a Swiss cheese nature of gun laws in this country, where there are some states with very stringent laws and some with super, super loose laws. And what we see, especially when you think about southern states like Mississippi, where so many Black folks left Mississippi to Chicago, and they arrive in these conditions where folks have been redlined in the slums and segregation. But then you have these familial connections from folks down south and up north. And so we have that iron pipeline straight up north in the communities that have already been disinvested in and already gone through so much trauma. It's easy access. But also, I think another part of this book that I think folks might find interesting is, you know, we understand the modern gun rights movement as the NRA and some other organizations. But really, we didn't get what we understand to be a modern day gun rights movement until after Brown v. Board of Education, when Black folks were fighting for a fuller kind of citizenship in this country. The response was a stoking of fear, right? Because now that Black folks are free, what does it mean for the rest of us? And so that's when you start seeing a stoking of that fear in white communities, where that's where you really begin to see the robust machine behind gun rights, not just as, you know, a tool for hunting and just self-defense. It was in opposition of some greater force, and that was freedom for Black people.
Well, that stops you in your tracks when you're reading along and you say that, you know, one of the most overlooked and underappreciated responses to Brown v. Board is the rise in gun violence. And then you mm-hmm. just illuminate it. Because yeah. you're writing about the big continuum in this book, which is what is so valuable, I think. And you talk about issues of poverty and issues of mental health as well.
That's right. Because a lot of this is, I mean, so we have, you know, the historic dynamic between Black folks and guns. Mm-hmm. And then you have the big machinery of the gun rights movement and then the industry. But I think that's the part that we also miss. While the industry, while there's so much pain and families are paying an exorbitant price, there isn't an industry that is getting wealthy and the profits are rising as more people die. But even within all those big cogs moving, there is that part that you mentioned right there, the mental health of what it means to experience gun violence and to survive gun violence. If you go to places that experience gun violence most, and you think about Chicago or New Orleans or Baltimore or pick a city, USA, there are more survivors than those who are killed. Mm-hmm. And so imagine what it's like for a neighbor to see someone down the street killed, or to have a mother who's lost a child or two, or a father trying to protect their son or daughter from what they know is violent. And people have to carry that. And I tell some of those stories in the book of people who are wrestling with what it means to lose someone super close to them. When I talked to my own mother, she described it in a way I've heard from other folks time and again, that when you lose someone close to you to violence, it's almost as if you lose a limb. Yeah. And much as you try to overcompensate, there's always this shadow limb there. You know it's missing.
Now, when you talk about cost, it's both literal and metaphorical, of course, but you reckon at one point that the financial cost is about $1 million for a single gunshot injury. But the
That's
metaphorical
right.
cost is far greater.
No, there's the two costs. There's the literal yeah. cost of when you think about a young man or woman who is shot and paralyzed. Right. Yep. As soon as that bullet hits flesh, most of the time they don't have private insurance. So mm-hmm. we're all paying that cost. And then you think about the investigation into violence and all the overtime and all the court costs and then businesses and taxpayers fleeing places that experience violence. And on and on and on, there's this literal cost that should be exorbitant for any of us. Hundreds of billions of dollars every single year. But all those costs, I believe, pale in comparison to the cost that people pay. Imagine your father, your mother, your son or daughter, and then your neighbor is also experiencing that same kind of loss, and on and on. I think those costs are incalculable.
Mm-hmm. Now, your New Orleans experiences and your role as a journalist are important parts of this book. And you know we're just coming off the big Katrina-versary. So
right.
I wonder how you're feeling about gun violence in the wake of Katrina, which you write about so well.
You know, New Orleans is the kind of place that, you know, is so beloved for so many reasons, yet it will break your heart at mm-hmm. every turn. And yeah. my experience in New Orleans, I almost immediately fell in love with the place. But there is a certain kind of brazenness with the violence that is quite frankly gut-wrenching. And so they're experiencing the heft of all those things we talked about, the segregation and the easy access to guns. But there's also this other kind of collective sense of celebration, but there's also this collective sense of grief. And in New Orleans after Katrina, for a moment, there was this peace. But then people who were already dealing with so much were dealing with another kind of loss that exacerbated all of the trauma that they had experienced already. And so there was the flood of Katrina and the breakdown of the levees and infrastructure. But long before then, there had been a breakdown in the systems that are supposed to be supporting people. And few places in this country, a few communities, have experienced the kind of corruption and brutality at the hands of police than mm-hmm. New Orleans has. And when you have an absence of justice, that kind of violence just replicates itself. But New Orleans, you know, this was a tough one because, you know, you think about 20 years later, and as much as folks have been able to piece their lives back together again, and I talked to some amazing folks and organizations who are working to heal the many wounds left by Katrina, you know, those flood lines may be invisible. They're still there, though. So yeah. many people are still suffering, and that's, I think it's a shame compounding itself.
And you were here during the height of it. You were here in 2005 and 2006, right?
That's right. I landed in New Orleans from Philadelphia about 4 months before Katrina. So I got to town in April mm-hmm. as a police and a crime reporter. And so I was really just getting my feet under me when the bottom dropped out. Yeah, I'll never forget that. Never.
And, you know, the police were making sure everybody had guns who needed them after the storm. You write about that, which was so interesting.
Oh, that was, it's almost like the Twilight Zone where everything was flipped upside down. And there was this moment where a small band of us remained in the city after the storm. And the Times-Picayune went to Baton Rouge because the paper on Howard Avenue was taking flood water. And we hear this knock on the door, and there's a police officer and one of the photographers, one of our guys, who was very close to the police. And the police officer, I'll never forget, asked, "Hey, are you guys armed?" And we said, "No." He said, "You should be." And handed us a shotgun and a revolver.
Right.
And in that moment, that was one of many moments that truly blew my mind. It speaks to these wild dynamics, not just in that city, but also that who we should be afraid of, right, mm-hmm. in that city. Meanwhile, you're hearing stories of that turned out to be true, of vigilantes killing Black folks who were trying to flee, of police brutality, the likes we've never seen. People looking for safety being murdered. Those days were harrowing, to say the least.
And then later on, you write about Deborah Cotton, Big Red, who was a victim of the Mother's Day second line shooting, and a friend.
Yeah, that was my girl. We met, my first days in New Orleans. I met her at a bar in the French Quarter, and we just hit it off and became fast friends. And Deborah was so full of life and exuberance, and she was just had this big smile, and she was just a character. Mm-hmm. She'd go on to cover second line culture and was like a culture reporter. When I first met her, she wanted to be a chef, but she ended up after the storm documenting the return of the brass band, the second line. And she was just like, loved the culture of New Orleans.
Yeah.
And she happened to be at that second line in 2013, where 20 some people were shot, and she was among the most gravest injured. And she actually lived for a number of years after that. But ultimately, 4 years later, as I was writing this book, end up dying. And I talked to her just months before she died for the book. And she talked about the physical wounds that she suffered, how those bullets gnarled up her insides. But it also reshaped how she had to live her everyday life and her relationships and just trying to love a city that bites sometimes. But even at that, before she died, she forgave the young men who were involved in her shooting.
Which so
was
amazing.
Very Deborah-like.
So amazing, yes. If you're just joining us, my guest is Tremaine Lee, whose new book is 1,000 Ways to Die, The True Cost of Violence on Black Life in America. Now, one of the other things you do in the latter part of the book, you're so good at showing the way communities are impacted by gun violence. And you write with great passion and insight about the Topps grocery store shooting in upstate New York.
Another one of those moments where it's like we're all bearing some piece of that loss, and I felt it too. To think about a normal day at a grocery store in a neighborhood, everyone knows each other. You know the butcher, you know the baker. It's the older folks and the younger ones, literally an oasis in this community. And to have a white supremacist go to this community and go to the store precisely for that reason, because he knew he'd find community. He knew he'd find Black folks. Mm-hmm. And among the dead, elders, young folks who were all contributing to their communities in some way. And to go back a year after that vicious, vicious slaughter, and to stand where those people died and see a community grappling with what it means to come back. Is there any coming back? What does it mean to forgive or not forgive? What does it mean to fight in the name of folks you've lost? But to still see a community that is as whole as could be expected, but there is something deeper in communities like that who have suffered much. They find a way to bring a faith and a strength of spirit that I don't know if I have. Yeah. I don't know if I have that in me. But time and again, folks, show what we're actually made of. And I say we collectively, the best of us. And that's another one of those moments. Think about 10 people killed in a grocery store and killed because they were Black and because they were there. Mm-hmm. And that speaks to the other. There's the violence of the gun and the trigger, but there's the violence of these systems, and not just policy systems or governance systems, but systems of hate that have operated in this country for a very long time and manifest time and again, whether it's Tufts or whether it's the Mother Emanuel Church in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. You see it time and again.
Or to the Annunciation Church, I must say.
That's right. That's right.
Now, all this feeds into your portrait of Black death as a spectacle, too, in the ways in which Black grief and sadness have become part of our daily news, and how painful that there is a layer of pain to it, I think.
Oh, no, it definitely adds a layer on that. We see it time and again in a way that it would be hard to imagine that we'd see our white neighbors portrayed in the news, or that kind of death. If we saw them, we don't see this. We just don't see it because half the deaths in the country, black folks disproportionately are impacted by gun violence, but the other half are white, right? The other half of the shooters and the victims are white, and we never see those deaths splattered across the news. It's not the kind of fodder that we enjoy in this country for some reason. But I feel like it's another layer of dehumanization that we've been something else, and that's okay for this community to feel this kind of pain. It's okay for us as a society to consume that kind of those images, but it's rubbing salt in the wounds. And I think it only feeds, again, there's that violence of the trigger, there's that physical violence, but there's that the violence of otherness, and that this is okay, but it's always been okay. Lest we forget those images of lynching in this country, where you'd see families gathered around bodies, some smiling with their children. If I was walking with my daughter and we saw somebody getting beat up, I'd turn away.
Yeah.
Because we shouldn't be exposed to that, let alone the murders, right? And so it's baked into the fabric of this country. It always has been.
And you write, too, about the difficulty and the kind of double responsibility of being a black journalist writing about these issues.
That's right. I mean, it's a burden, but also a blessing to be a bearer of the truth and, again, to shine light in dark places. But it is also tricky because, you know, you have both sides of it. We're operating in a system largely operated, and the gatekeepers are largely white, many who don't really have a sense of the communities or cultures that we cover. Mm-hmm. And then the other side, you have black communities who rightly so are very suspicious of the machines and the media because of how they're portrayed. And so to be both black and a journalist in mainstream newspapers comes with a pressure and a tension that's difficult to navigate.
Oh,
because
sure.
There is this two-ness, right? You are a black man in America, but you're also operating within the machine. And so it's a difficult one to navigate, but it also comes with great responsibility. And so, you know, I've existed in that space, and it hasn't always been easy. But now that I've matured and I've been a journalist for 20 plus years, I do kind of understand what it means to heal yourself now while you're doing the work. Because if not, I think, you know, it bears down on you. And then I had a heart attack. And there's no doubt for me, it was coming off of Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown and then Ferguson, Missouri, and Freddie Gray in Baltimore. And I was on the front lines of all these cases after the early part of my career covering a different kind of black death. And so I wasn't fully processing it as it was happening. And so I think it's not for the faint of heart, but it's also been the greatest honor of my life to tell our stories.
We've been talking with Tremaine Lee, whose first book, which is expertly reported and beautifully written, is 1,000 Ways to Die, The True Cost of Violence on Black Life in America. You can meet him Thursday, September 18th at 6 at Baldwin & Company when he appears in conversation with Sharice Gibson. Tremaine, thank you so much.
Thank you so very much.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Two local authors will speak at the Saturday Writers Clinic, September 13th at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. At 9:30, Constance Adler, author of Sight Unseen, discusses the presence of animal characters in fiction and how to include an animal's point of view. At 11 a.m., David Armand discusses some of the basic principles for those who want to write memoirs. The Dickens Fellowship of New Orleans begins its reading of David Copperfield with a discussion of chapters 1 through 15. Saturday, September 13th from 2 to 4, that's at the Bright Library at Metairie Park Country Day School. Blue Cypress Books presents Quiz and Quizability, a Jane Austen trivia night, Saturday, September 13th from 7 to 10. Addie Kitchens discusses and signs Dominion, Tuesday, September 16th at 6 at Baldwin & Company. David Michael Schneider discusses and signs Crime in Colonial New Orleans, Terror on the Frontier, Tuesday, September 16th at 6 at Octavia Books. Eve Lyon discusses How to Stretch Your Grocery Dollars. That's at the general meeting of the Friends of the Jefferson Public Library, Wednesday, September 17th at 10 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. And it's time to sign up to volunteer for the Big Book Sale, coming up October 24th through 26th at the Pontchartrain Center. Joe Boyd appears in conversation with Jay Massa and signs And the Roots of Rhythm Remain, A Journey Through Global Music, Wednesday, September 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. Tremaine Lee appears in conversation with Cherise Gibson and signs 1,000 Ways to Die, The True Cost of Violence on Black Life in America, Thursday, September 18th at 6 at Baldwin & Company. Martha Park discusses and signs World Without End, Essays on Apocalypse and After, Thursday, September 18th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Derby Giscaire will give a presentation entitled Epidemics That Shape New Orleans, Thursday, September 18th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. And The Last Laugh, Wit, Wisdom, and 10 Years of the Walker Percy Weekend is coming up September 19th through 20th in St. Francisville. Headquartered at Conundrum Bookstore, the weekend includes panel discussions, a lunchtime book club, a front porch tour and bourbon tasting, a Taste of South supper, and an appearance by musician Sonny Landreth. This is likely the last one, so if you love Walker Percy, it's time to go. For more information, visit walkerpercyweekend.org. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.